You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. During the presidency of George W. Bush, the administration talked a lot about God and the role of religion in the United States government. Now, here's a bit of a parody from the TV show Family Guy that talks a little bit about that idea.
In other news, the White House was stunned today when President Bush received a phone call from God himself.
Hey, George, it's God.
Wow. Hey, how you doing?
Good. Hey, listen, big favor. Is there any way that you could kind of, from now on, just sort of downplay our relationship a little more in your public addresses?
What do you mean?
Well, I'll just give you an example. Like when you make comments like, God wanted me to be president. You know, that would be an example of maybe something to just kind of keep to yourself, you know? Just to kind of, like, distance yourself from me a bit more.
Well, sure. I mean, if you want.
Great. Thanks. Ooh, that's Cheney. I gotta take it. Yes, sir.
Well, during the Clinton, we're laughing a little bit.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm going to introduce our guest here. Before I go to the next thing, Angie Schneiderman is an attorney with Moore, Heffernan, is it Mueller, Johnson,
yes,
and Meese in Sioux City. She's here to talk with us today about President Trump's executive order last week. And also Ryan, is it Dole or Dowell?
Dowell,
one sacred bomb, is the pastor of First Congregational United Church of Sioux City. And also with us is Bruce Forbes. He is a United Methodist minister, and he's a professor of history at Morningside College.
Hi.
Good to be here. You guys, it's good to have you here. Today we're going to talk a little bit about that executive order. President Donald Trump, last week, he brought up this order. He wants to basically make it easier for churches, pastors, to talk about politics, and other tax-exempt groups as well, but mostly it's been churches who've been, and synagogues and mosques have been talking about this issue. It makes it easier for them to talk about political candidates and, if not, maybe endorse them. And last week, President Trump spoke to a group of religious leaders at the White House and the Rose Garden about the order that asked the executive branch to honor and enforce existing protections for religious liberty.
It was Thomas Jefferson who said, "The God who gave us life gave us liberty." Our founding fathers believed that religious liberty was so fundamental that they enshrined it in the very First Amendment of our great and beloved Constitution. Yet for too long, the federal government has used the power of the state as a weapon against people of faith, bullying and even punishing Americans for following their religious beliefs. That's been happening. That is why I am signing today an executive order to defend the freedom of religion and speech in America, the freedoms that we've wanted, the freedoms that you fought for so long, and we are doing it in just a little while right over here.
But the president really didn't get rid of the Johnson Amendment. He'd need Congress to help him do that. So today we're going to talk about what this means in terms of freedom of speech and religion and politics. Angie, maybe we could start with you just because I'd like to talk about the legal ramifications of this executive order. I mean, what kind of effect will it have, do you think?
Well, honestly, I think a lot of organizations were disappointed with the breadth of the order itself, because it really, I don't think, is going to create any changes that we're going to see at a local or national level in terms of speech-based content.
Well, how much would a president or Congress have to do to really put teeth into this?
You know, there'd need to be more directive. And part of the problem is he's using an executive order to try to accomplish that. He's not actually changing the underlying law. He is simply using his executive powers to give direction to the administrative agencies that enforce the laws. And so until those underlying laws are actually changed, you're not going to see any change in the scope of what any given agency can do.
So Congress would have to get involved,
precisely.
Basically. Yeah. Ryan, what was your response to this?
I had a similar response from the sort of faith leader perspective. I think a lot of it was, there was much made of it. I think there had been leaks of drafts of this executive order, and so there was a lot of talk about what's this going to be, how's it going to work. But when the actual executive order came out, my understanding is that there were kind of two parts to it. One has to do with the Johnson Amendment, which prohibits 501c3 nonprofit organizations like communities of faith from intervening in political campaigns or endorsing specific or opposing specific candidates or parties. The other had to do with sort of conscience-based things, like the contraceptive mandate, you know, the law that says that employers, regardless of their religious affiliations, need to provide contraceptives in their health insurance plans. In both cases, the language was pretty broad and nonspecific. So, you know, it said that the people who are responsible for enforcing these laws should consider ways of working within existing laws so that people have freedom of conscience.
Right.
And then, you know, that the freedom of speech of religious leaders and religious communities should be respected. And I think a lot of people are like, well, that's already kind of been happening. It's not like there has been an inquisition of any sort on religious leaders or religious communities. I think if you look at the role of religion in politics, it's usually not much of a mystery who religious leaders are supporting, even in terms of parties and candidates. So even from my perspective, it doesn't seem to change a whole lot.
Yeah. Bruce, what was your reaction? You teach a lot about this issue, religion, politics, culture.
Well, as has been said, I think we have two issues going on here. The Johnson Amendment interests me a lot. And it, I mean, this goes back, I was kind of double checking this today. it's an amendment to really IRS law in from 1954, introduced, it's called the Johnson Amendment because it was introduced by Senator at that time, Lyndon Johnson, later president. And I think at the time it was introduced, it was not controversial at all. I mean, almost unanimously adopted. And it was, as you said, it was simply saying that for nonprofit organizations, including churches, under that particular category, they were restricted from directly participating in endorsing candidates, etc.
Right.
And the thing is, when you were saying, well, what Trump said, how could it get teeth? The problem is this law hasn't ever had teeth.
Mm.
So that it's never really been enforced. I mean, what is the statistic? One person in the whole history of it has been audited and no one has been punished.
Right.
And so you have various clergy who want to endorse candidates from the pulpit. And so they've made a show of it and they've had various Sundays, Freedom Sundays, when all these ministers have endorsed candidates from the pulpit and there has been no repercussion because the IRS hasn't followed up on it. So it's not that, it's not a bullying that's happening because it just hasn't happened. So this, but some people want the law changed, I guess, and Donald Trump is sympathetic with them and so he's done this order. But I'm not sure it changes anything. We were talking here before the interviews that the ACLU, you might expect them to challenge something like this. And there are a number of people have said, well, we don't think we're going to bother on that issue because it would change nothing.
Right. They've decided to do nothing right now.
Correct.
So that tells you something.
Yeah. But I do think, I mean, it is an interesting issue to think about because if the law is changed in some way so that people could contribute to churches knowing that that minister was going to campaign for a particular candidate, then does this become a way, I mean, instead of making a political contribution to a political party, which is not tax deductible, could you contribute to a church because you know they're very active and then you know that minister is going to push in that direction? I mean, there are all kinds of questions that even religious people are asking. I mean, people are saying, do we want our churches to become just platforms for someone's political right. agenda?
Well, and beyond just the speech thing, my understanding, you guys might know better than I, that the Johnson Amendment not only prohibits speech, but it prohibits contributions from nonprofit organizations to political campaigns. So if the president intends to repeal the Johnson Amendment, which, as you said, he'd need Congress to do, would that mean that churches and other nonprofits all of a sudden get to make campaign contributions? And then I wonder, how would churchgoers feel about that, knowing that their tithes and offerings potentially could end up in the coffers of a political campaign?
Yeah, I mean, I was reading that some of the churches that had been looked at, you know, recently in the last campaign for maybe approaching this standard were some churches in the South, some largely African-American churches who had a lot of problems with Donald Trump. And yet they didn't really cross the line, but people were questioning, like, what was their political motive in this, and does it really, like, reach this level, I guess.
Sure.
So apparently not. But and then there was a case where I think the one case where it was somewhat actionable had to do with someone who was talking about the Clintons, and that was like back in the 90s. So it's been a long time, hasn't it?
Right, with an isolated instance of right. enforcement.
And nothing happened, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah. And, so oh, go ahead,
And
Bruce.
The other thing that's important is that all of this law does not bar churches from being involved in social issues, because it's right. not that religion is just something private and has nothing to do with your public life. For most religious people of whatever religion, it matters sure. what's happening in the world, and so they may become activist right. on that. So I think it's endorsing particular candidates or affiliating with particular parties that's more problematic, because you have all kinds of churches that, I mean, you're working for civil rights or what. You know, think right. of Martin Luther King Jr.
Right.
And even more recently, I think issue-based political advocacy sure. has been fair game for churches. For more conservative churches, you see them getting involved in political advocacy, trying to limit abortion and gay marriage. On the progressive side, you have some, like the United Church of Christ, actively getting involved to allow gay marriage, saying this is our religious freedom that's at stake. We actively do marry gay couples, and we should be able to do that. That's issue-based, you know, so that's always been allowed.
And religious groups have been involved on both sides of those issues.
And always have, yes, from yes, slavery right. to yes. Jim Crow yeah. to abortion and gay marriage.
And as you said, I mean, whether it goes too far, sometimes it depends on the people within that denomination or that church. One example I think of, I spent a lot of time up in Minnesota, and a few years ago they had on the ballot a constitutional amendment that would be kind of against gay marriage. And the Catholic Church, the bishop at that time, took a very strong stand on that mm-hmm. and committed $500,000
wow.
Toward advocating for the passage of this constitutional amendment, which, by the way, it didn't pass. But can you imagine that caused some upheaval among Catholics themselves?
Sure.
Just as you'd said before, $500,000, I'm contributing to the church, but I didn't think it was for this, right. even when they agreed with the issue. So I do think that some leaders who want more latitude here could face blowback from their own membership.
Well, in the Catholic Church, it seems that usually what I have heard, and actually what they have on several websites, they talk about political candidates and issues, and they say, we do not tell you who to vote for. We say you need to follow your conscience,
yes.
but if you're a Catholic of good standing, your conscience should be in line with what the church teaches, which is against abortion and a number of issues, including the death penalty. So this should affect
right.
how you vote. So Ryan, what do you think about this way of kind of going about this, kind of directs your vote in a way?
Sure. I mean, I think all people of faith bring their values and convictions with them into the voting booth. I think that's as it should be. If faith were something that we just sort of compartmentalized and didn't allow to affect the rest of our lives, then it wouldn't be that vital of faith. I think the Catholic Church is right to say, you know, your deepest convictions that are formed by your faith should indeed affect the way you vote and how you engage the political process. I think Catholics are in a particularly interesting position because Catholic social teaching tends to align more with conservative political parties on social and quote-unquote moral issues, but tends to align more closely with progressive platforms on things like poverty and immigration. I think that there are a lot of Catholics who are kind of caught in the middle, and it's why many bishops have said it's about your intent. You know, if you choose to vote for somebody who takes a stand on an issue that is contrary to church teaching because they've taken a stand that is very much in accordance with church teaching on another issue,
right,
go ahead and vote for them. That's up to you and your conscience, and I think that's reasonable.
I think it's some political figures have sort of gotten censured by the church for, you know, supporting abortion. Or Ted Kennedy, the late Ted Kennedy, was one who was always sort of getting his knuckles wrapped, but lightly. let's put it that way.
Sure.
But, you know, I think that in most churches, I don't know if there's that much pressure in maybe other churches with the Catholic Church issue. Those issues are so tied to what the church teaches, life and death and all of that.
And prioritizing some
right
issues over others. And I think in those cases, it tended to involve particular bishops in certain areas who sometimes
right
would say, we will not offer the Eucharist to any political candidate who takes such and such a stand. But that was not the stand that was taken by all bishops in the United States.
Right. You're listening to The Exchange, and we're talking about President Trump's executive order last week that tried to take a more gentle line with religious organizations to endorse or talk about political candidates. I'm here with Angie Schneiderman, an attorney with Moore, Heffernan, Mohler, Johnson & Meese in Sioux City, Bruce Forbes. He is an ordained United Methodist minister and a professor of history at Morningside College. And Ryan Dowell Baum is the pastor of the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Sioux City. I was looking back at, you know, some of the history of the church's involvement in politics, and you look back at colonial times, and a lot of what ministers would talk about would be things we would think of today as political, talking about, you know, if it was a more established church, they would try and defend the British crown. If it were a different kind of church, they'd say, well, you need to get involved in this uprising and the revolution. Do we still kind of feel like the church is part of that? I think it still exists today when we talk about immigration and social movements and even patriotism. I feel like there's this need in America for us to feel patriotic within our churches, or we wouldn't have services on Thanksgiving and the 4th of July. You know what I mean? Like,
sure,
there's a definite tie in there, but what is it? Hard to get to.
I think it's always existed and always will.
Yeah.
I look at women's suffrage, you know, the right to vote even. And that was tied to, you know, some churches advocating that the man is the head of the household and he is the one to express the opinion and the vote of the household. And
yeah,
and then, of course, you had the other side. And
sure. It was Congregationalists and Quaker women and men who were some of the most vocal advocates for women's suffrage. And the same thing is true on slavery.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the civil rights movement.
Slavery is a great example of how intertwined they were, because you have at least three major divisions that split on this issue.
Right.
Where you had sincere Christians on both sides. I mean, this was Methodists and Baptists and Presbyterians.
That's right.
And some of those, it took 100 years before those groups got together again. So these social and political views are deep within the church. I mean, you can't separate it out from the culture of which you're a part.
Right. And I think, as we were also talking about before the interview, it can be a tricky balance, because on the one hand, I think people of faith want to believe that there is something that is bigger than politics, you know, that there is some realm that transcends the nitty-gritty of human arguing and debating and politicking. On the other hand, the gospel, speaking from a Christian perspective, but any religious core message has political implications. It's about the deepest parts of what it means to be a human being and what it means to live together in human community. And I think, again, from a Christian perspective, if you look at who Jesus was, he was arrested and executed as a political prisoner, you know, as an enemy of the empire,
of Rome,
you know,
right,
with the king of the Jews, you know, above his head. That's a political statement.
But he was one who said, you know, they always say, you know, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
That's right.
That's simplistic, but they always bring that up.
Right.
They always talk about that.
Yes. And so it's this bad. It's like, on the one hand, he said, there's something about this that transcends Caesar.
Right.
On the other hand, that doesn't mean that it has no bearing for how we comport ourselves within the empire.
Right. Because people were saying to him, you know, why should we have to pay our taxes? Why should we give them money?
Right.
Race? And that people say that today.
Yes. Well, and that's what's really interesting to me. You know, I've been in some ways really ambivalent about this contraceptive mandate, which is sort of the other half of the executive order. On the one hand, I believe strongly that women have a right to comprehensive contraceptive care and reproductive health care. On the other hand, being able to be a conscientious objector, to live in accordance to one's conscience, historically has been an important and beloved part of what it means to be an American citizen. The fact that historic peace churches, they had to fight for it, right? There were Quakers and Mennonites who were jailed during World War I for refusing to go off to war. But eventually, the Supreme Court said, no, conscientious objection is a fundamental constitutional right. And yet, there are limits to the rights of conscientious objection. For example, even though as a Mennonite or Quaker, one may not have to participate in combat, one may not conscientiously object to pay taxes, which fund the military. So where is the line? It's complicated.
Yeah.
Can I say, this doesn't directly deal with that, but how religious belief on social issues can get into politics, it slides right into them. One analogy I use in ethics is that people say, okay, I care about hunger, so I'd like to do something as a church group to feed people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, that's not enough. It's not enough to give a person a fish. You ought to teach them how to fish, or
right,
give them a pole so that they know. So everybody says, yes, that's good too. Well, what if, as a third step, you find out there's no access to the water? Now what?
And I
think now we're talking about something that's political.
Yes. Right.
You know, if you think that's, if the first two were important, isn't the third one too?
Right.
Right. Well, I think President Trump, if you asked me 10 years ago, would Donald Trump be, you know, gaining the support of the evangelical movement
yes.
in any way whatsoever, I would say no. And mm-hmm. here today, you know, he is pushing that agenda.
Yeah, I mean,
things have changed.
It has seemed to me like some sort of alternate reality that a sort of thrice married serial adulterer who brags about groping women has become the standard bearer for the evangelical movement. But this is where we are.
It kind of reminded me of the old saying about the Baptists and bootleggers, you know, the prohibition, you know, strange bedfellows and whatever mm-hmm. works for you both, because they're each getting something out of this, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Enlightened self-interest, I suppose.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, it's but I wonder, you know, now this has started. I just wonder sort of, you know, what, as we go forward, how do you think this will play out? And maybe I'll start with Angie.
Well, speaking strictly about the executive order, I think the strongest aspect of that has been the portion that relates to the contraceptive mandate in health insurance, and the fact that the president has given the regulatory agencies liberty to consider less stringent enforcement of that particular aspect of the law.
Mm. So basically, this will go forward in a way, sort of a I don't know. I guess it's...
I don't want to go so far as to say it creates loopholes.
Yeah.
But it certainly lends itself to turning a blind eye.
Ah, well, that makes sense.
Which, isn't it called discretion?
Discretion, yes, is another way to say that.
Well, I've heard some people say, you know, part of it just has to do with staffing at these government agencies, whether it's the IRS or whether it's, you know...
EPA or...
Right. Yeah. It's like, we don't have enough bureaucrats to like have people continually watching these relatively small, relatively poor organizations, making sure they're not crossing some line.
Right. And it's not as though we've had, we have budgets that are allocated towards that sort of enforcement. Right. So there's nothing that you're going to take away from the agency to, you know, ensure that that enforcement is
sure
completed.
Mm. Yeah. And so, you know, I wonder as the president goes forward, I think maybe these tactics seem to work. I wonder if he'll be a little more bold as he goes forward.
In terms of?
Well, his initiatives, his executive orders. You know, Obama had a lot, President Obama had a lot of executive orders as well.
Chris, you have to say, I mean, I guess these are political points people make. Most of the time, previous presidents would try to get through things through the legislature.
Right.
And then after that failed, then they would resort to executive orders. In this case, everything's starting with executive orders, so we kind of reversed the process.
It almost like it's almost like a shot from the bow, like this is where we're going.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things, this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, both with the Obama administration and the Trump administration. I mean, my understanding of the intent of the Constitution, and for a while it more or less worked this way, that in order to make legislation happen, it was the legislators who had to negotiate and argue it out and put something forward. And executive orders were about how do we enforce these laws, this legislation. Part of what I think happened, that at least talking with some of my more conservative friends, there was frustration on both sides during the Obama administration, especially around immigration reform. You know that the
exactly
that Obama got impatient and started legislating
right.
from
right.
the White House.
Well, we have been talking today about the executive order signed by President Trump last week that calls for a weakening of the law that bars churches and tax-exempt groups from endorsing political candidates called the Johnson Amendment. I've been talking today with Angie Schneiderman of the law firm Moore, Heffernan, Moeller, Johnson & Meese in Sioux City. Also Bruce Forbes, an ordained United Methodist minister, a professor of history at Morningside College, and Ryan Dalbaum, pastor of the First Congregational United Church of Sioux City. And you're listening to The Exchange here on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. And we'll change course a little bit and talk about a book that talks about the history of Iowa, a novel. Stuart Harris is an author and a playwright who grew up in California, but he has an Iowa heritage. His grandmother and his mother came from Iowa farms. His latest novel is called The Northeast Quarter. It's set in Winfield, Iowa in 1918. Colonel Wallace Carson asks his 10-year-old granddaughter and eventual heir to his agricultural empire to promise she'll safeguard the Northeast Quarter, the choice piece of land from which the empire was founded, and readily accepts, little knowing what awaits her. Now, Harris says the inspiration from the book came from a conversation he had with his mother not long before she died.
When Mother was born and as a little girl, there were 20 farms in this estate, and this parallels Northeast Quarter a little bit. Now there's only one left, and they particularly dwindled and kind of went their way during the Great Depression with the economy. Well, she saw what the Depression did to her neighbors, and so she, you could say, had a, I guess you'd say, I would say a fear or a concern that she, as she was growing up, and that was what would happen to my family if there were a second Great Depression, and how would they survive? So as I was growing up, she would every now and then would say, "Now, Stu, I want you to promise me that you will not sell Section 10." Now, Section 10 is one of these farms, and I'd say, "Okay, Mother, I won't sell it." and go along, and then she might say 2 years later, Stu, now just remember, don't sell that farm. This went clear up to actually almost the day she died. This was in 2006 on her deathbed. You know, she started to say, Stu, and I said, Mother, I won't sell the farm. I will not sell the farm. Well, her concern or her belief was that if, say, we had the Second Depression, she thought maybe the government might pass a law that, this is just her idea, that would say you cannot own property unless you live on it. And she thought, we've got to have something in case, you know, I were hit, that I could go back to and live off the land or live, you know, have it maybe rent a trailer or something, but live on that farm until the crisis was over. And that was, I call it, say, mother's wisdom. And this became the plot line for my book, where this grandfather asks his granddaughter not to sell the best acreage on the estate.
He dies pretty quickly in the book.
I was imagining in like some kingdom, for example, where the king is at a banquet, and he looks down the table of the royal family at the princess, and he says, "I want you to promise me you won't sell, I will call it again, the northeast quarter." And she's, "Okay, Grandpa." And he says, "No, you promise me as if your life and soul depends upon it." And she promises, and he's killed off. Well, of course, this leaves the royal family open for every conniver in the kingdom to converge on the kingdom and start carving it up. We have the, like, princess who's made a promise to the king. But the problem is the princess is only 10 years old. And how in the heck is she going to keep this promise, because she's only a little girl? And any time she speaks up, they send her to her room or whatever. So how is she going to keep this promise? She has to actually match wits for years with all sorts of characters until she gets old enough, and then she can step in and take action.
Yeah, and there are a lot of connivers in the book. I mean, one that is sort of the main villain of the book, though.
I wanted to set a character up who is the complete opposite in every way of Anne's grandfather. Anne's grandfather would be the equivalent maybe of like Zeus on Mount Olympus. In other words, he's a benevolent ruler. He's respected. He has a speech in the first chapter where before he dies. It kind of, I hope, sets the ethical or the moral tone for the whole book. And everything has to measure up to him, and of course it doesn't. The villain, and I even gave him a kind of a theatrical entrance, he's the opposite. He's been waiting like underworld or whatever, in the shadows, to come out, and he, in this moment of weakness, flourishes like a flower in a, you know, a hothouse or whatever. And so he's the opposite. And so he's the challenge that Anne has to face.
The thing is, he comes in and he sort of takes advantage of the situation with her grandmother, and she doesn't know who to turn to. And in the period, anyway, ladies who had powerful husbands often were not clued in on the business so much.
Yeah, I wanted to make her a almost tragic figure, in the sense she knows how to run the place. I mean, she knows by listening to her husband, and even her daughter-in-law says, you know, Mama, you, or not daughter, her like daughter says, Mama, just give the order. The order isn't a woman's order. It isn't a man's order. It's the order to give to the managers to run it.
Right.
And she's so afraid of failing and so afraid of what anyone would think that she's paralyzed. And it sets her up completely for this guy to come in, and he uses a little bit of modern lingo in the sense he says, you know, I know you're a strong woman. I appreciate strong women. I know what you're going through. And, of course, I would imagine, hopefully, any woman reading this now would start going, you know, wake up, lady. We know what this guy's doing. And, of course, Anne, the little girl's the only one that spots him.
Yeah, she does.
She's the only one, and, of course, this sets her and this guy up as mortal enemies. And the only person that's strong enough to stand up to him, and he admires it in a way, is his enemy, is Anne.
When he first starts to talk to her, well, when her grandmother's in the bank and they're surrounding her with all these people trying to get in her good graces, he sidles right up to her and starts smooth-talking her. And she does not want any of it.
No. And see, this book began as a three-act play. And so I wanted to give him a theatrical entrance. So in this scene in the bank, he's hovering in the shadows. We don't really see him. Anne doesn't see him. There's just this dark silhouette with a pair of eyes and this purring voice out of the dark. And then after Anne and her grandmother leave, then I give him if it's ever made in a play or a movie, a really good actor's entrance, where he comes slowly out of the dark, and talking, and then he comes out into the light, and we finally see him, and he announces he's going to marry this woman.
And in fact, he comes right out and tells one of the other characters.
He's definitely a monster.
He has no qualms about telling.
None. He's not ashamed of being evil. He puts it right out on the table. This is what I'm going to do. But his followers are all kind of the devious ones. In other words, they hide their faces from the world in the sense as to who they are. They're like more devious. This guy's right out in the open.
Did your mom talk to you about what it was like growing up in Iowa? I'm assuming she did.
She lost both parents very young. And so she went from guardian to guardian. She was sent to boarding school. She was alone. Now, she wasn't facing any characters like this. I put them in because I enjoy, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson books where usually you have like a crooked uncle swindles the nephew out of the estate, and he has to go away and round up some people and come back and rout the, you know, villains. So I added that on. But she was alone a lot. And she made friends, but she, again, lost, I think, her mother when she was about 7 and her father, I think, when she was 14. When she was 18, she eloped with my dad. And this is parallel a little bit in the book, but Dad was a few years older. He was a college student who was very good at playing the piano. So again, during these years, he had this trio, and they would play in, say, country clubs. But every now and then, they'd do a night job in a speakeasy. Well, word got back to Audubon, speakeasy over the country club, and the college got lost. So by the time it got to Audubon, you know, Annis, my mom, was dating a bootlegger. And so when he came around, he'd say, no, or mother'd say, no, he's not a bootlegger. He's an insurance broker. He's in college. He's studying business. So I put that a little bit in the book, but... she eloped. This is in 1927. They were married 71 years.
Yeah, I know sometimes, especially, back in the day, if you go back about 50, 60 years and in small Iowa communities, outsiders were not always looked upon so well. I mean, it would take a while for people in smaller towns to accept others.
Well, the thing was they hadn't met Dad.
Right.
So they hadn't met him, and so they heard like one person to tell another person, and by the time that it got to the third or fourth person, the fact that he was a college student studying in business who had a night job occasionally to pay for his education, all that was gone. He was, but by the time it reached the fourth person or whatever, he was a bootlegger. And they had to go back and say, no, he's not. He's not. He's a young, a good guy. But when he came to Audubon later, I mean, sure, it was fine. But it was just at the beginning.
Have you heard any reaction to the book? People maybe who knew the play and now maybe see the book.
The thing that maybe is good, or I like it, or appreciate, is that this book, I've tried to do a like throwback to the kind of old books that were in the 1950s that would be written by, say, Edna Ferber, like Giant or Ice Palace, that were multi-generational, you know, family epic type stories set in a certain location, and you watch the characters grow, and you watch the like land around it change. And I want to do one of those. And so people who have read it and have, you know, written little, say, reviews on Amazon have liked it.
That was Stuart Harris talking about his novel, The Northeast Quarter. It's set in Iowa. It tells the story of a farm family from just after the First World War throughout the Depression. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Ghost Cat is Siouxland Public Media's Artist of the Month. Coming up this weekend, the Sioux City-based indie rock band will release its full-length album with a special show at Anthem, an entertainment venue inside the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino. Allie Carson has more.
When was the time that you had an existential crisis?
Oh, gosh.
Do you ever look at the sky and wonder if there's aliens living among us?
I'm Alex Irwin, I play guitar and sing.
I'm Steve Skog and I play drums.
I'm Cody Garwood and I play bass.
I'm Justin Yap, I play guitar.
Ghost Cat formed almost 3 years ago as a trio with Irwin, Garwood, and Skog, who all worked together at the Sioux City Conservatory of Music. In 2014, the indie rock band released its first album, a 7-song EP called Useless Fairy Tales. The band has evolved and matured in the last few years, and this Friday, Ghost Cat is releasing its first full-length album called How Infinite the Sky.
It's a lot more of optimism, I guess, in the writing, and less sadness and anger at the world and more acceptance and growth.
Is it because you're getting older and wiser?
That sounds pretentious-ish for me to say, but hopefully that's the goal of life, right? Yeah, hopefully we're wiser a little bit.
Well, how old are you guys? Like, late 20s, early 30s?
Late 20s,
okay.
Yeah.
It rushes over me, can you feel it? The city's still asleep, can you feel it? Just you and me and the colors of the trees. Just you and me.
Were there any, you know, specific moments that happened that, you know, really changed perspective, changed to more of that optimism?
For me personally, I have a daughter now, and I have had, she's 4 years old now, and that was kind of a start to a changing point in my life. And I just try to live every day differently. I don't know, like cliches, but they start to, you know, they work. They're true for people, saying for a reason. Like, don't take any day for granted or anything, you know. Notice all the beautiful things, like the sky that we've been seeing. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I loved the sky and trees and nature and being out in that, and I really try to be out in it now and remember, like, yeah, it's, we're lucky to be here, and it's beautiful. I don't know, simple things like that, but things that people forget.
Yeah, so fatherhood.
Yeah, for me. Yeah.
I think just getting older, we're kind of all in like a new chapter of our lives, or we're just starting it, I guess. And we're all starting to think about the future more and just not being like young 20-somethings anymore, you know, just kind of getting older.
Visions of stars and further black holes. Time travels through, but where does it go?
Had to pick a TV show that was best aligned with the story of your life, what would it be?
Lost.
Roseanne.
Story of our life?
Yeah, or like that you most closely identify with, man. Where it's like, oh yeah, that character, I feel you.
Michael Scott from The Office.
Angry Beavers.
Which one?
Both of them.
I mean, they're both pretty mad.
Both of them, yeah.
Dag it.
Growing up on the farm and, like, working with my family and everything, you know, trying to build this thing or whatever, whether it's a dam or, like, a business, and I work with my brothers a lot, so, like, I'm just going to go with that. Probably better answer.
It's a good metaphor.
That's what I'm going with.
What if I've already died? What if I'm not here alive? And the things we see around me are the things that come within me.
What was your intention or thoughts behind your title track?
Just being open to, like, the infinite, you know? The ultimate idea that, like, there's numerous possibilities. Like, anything is possible. And, like, one person's idea doesn't, like, because they believe that to be true, that doesn't mean that is the one way to live or to think or whatever. You know, everybody's different, and I don't know, and a lot more to that too, that, like, including, like, the idea of space and, like, other existence and all that. Like, I don't know, I think about stuff like that a lot, and it's just about the infinite, you know.
Well, and you know, like, now that you have a daughter and you see her going through that childhood of, you know, kids are so curious and just, like, that infinite wonder.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Do you see that in her and pull kind of some inspiration for your music from her?
Yeah, totally. I all of the positivity, I think, but then sometimes she provides me with some of that angst to come back to you. She's a naughty little kid.
Uh-huh. Can she just name a new song for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I wrote a song a while ago, and she always, like, sits and listens or plays or sings with me, and she named it Dingle Body. It's like, yeah, it's a good song. But that, or AKA Dingle Daddy. I don't know.
Is that a song we can hear on your new album?
No. You gotta look forward for that in the future.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me today.
Thanks so much.
Thank
for
you.
Having
you.
Us.
I've been talking with Alex Irwin, Steve Skog, Cody Garwood, and Justin Yap with Ghost Cat, Siouxland Public Media's Artist of the Month. They're having an album release show at the Hard Rock this Friday, joined by special guests Tapwater Shrimp, Pork Nocturnal, and Druid. Music starts at 8 p.m. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.
How infinite the sky, how deep inside your mind, the only way to go is up if you don't know. How infinite the sky, the ripples on the field. So surreal, like fingers of the dead brush light against their heads, the ripples on the field. I bet you didn't know what you're doing here, why you're doing, where you're from. Just let it blow, oh, and forget your fear as we make love under the sun. Hidden in their soul is more than we will know. The rings contain the cries of everything that's wise, hidden in their soul. Take me to that place, when standing face to face, our eyes connect as one, we're brighter than the sun. Take me to that place.
That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Join us next week. We'll take a look at alternative energy sources and how they're being utilized in Siouxland and beyond. And we'll also talk a little bit more about the news of the day. Thanks so much to my guest today, attorney Angie Schneiderman, Pastor Ryan Dalbaum of First Congregational United Church of Sioux City, and Bruce Forbes, an ordained United Methodist minister and professor of history at Morningside College. Also thanks to Allie Carson, Mark Munger, Steve Smith, and Rick Turner.